from NPR Music. You're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan, and this is the music of Mark Ronson. You came to know Mark Ronson this year by listening to the music of Lily Allen or maybe Amy Winehouse or even Bob Dylan. Mark Ronson's job is to make other people sound as good as they can. He's a producer. Born in London, he grew up in New York. And that's where he is today at our New York Bureau, and Mark Ronson's here to play DJ for us. He'll pick music that might have some meaning for him, maybe some music we might not have heard of. Mark, is that an apt description of a producer, make somebody sound as good as he can?
I think so. I think that's basically the purest old school definition, like going back to the kind of Quincy Jones, Phil Spector, that sort of era. Now a producer is sort of like more, we think of people that you hear the track and you know instantly, oh, that's a Timbaland track, that's this track, that's that track. But I'd like to think that my, you know, kind of lineage and what I do ties a bit more to the old school.
You certainly have a fingerprint and almost a whole handprint on stuff that you do. I think you do both of those things. When I hear your stuff, I like to think that I know it's your work, and then I also like to...
Because of all the damn trumpets.
Yeah. How
That's
many
not a lot of other people using. I think there was one review that came out in England when my album came out. The headline was like, has Mark Ronson blown it? Was the pun. Wow. Those English... Anyway, yeah, I think you're right. There is something that's definitely a... I definitely got a kind of like soft spot for the classics and that style of arrangement and really doing lovely things with whether strings, horns or real instruments. That it's just surprising that there's so little of that in today's music that you would recognize mine, because it's like, oh, there's actually live people playing on it. This might be a Mark Ronson record.
Yeah, how did that ever happen? I mean, I know when the big bands went away, they went away because they couldn't keep paying 30 musicians at a time. But, it's hard to understand how it was that all of a sudden, you didn't have those great R&B horns anymore. There were people out there playing this stuff, but maybe it was just easier and just quicker to play it on a keyboard or something.
I think that's probably, technology, people always get excited with it. So I imagine when the first keyboard horn samples came out, people were like, oh, this is cool, man, we're going to use this for a while. And then I think people just kind of forgot that there was amazing players. And I mean, something like an Amy Winehouse record that people listen to and go, God, did that take you like a year to make? It was like me and Amy demoed the songs for about 2 weeks, got them to a place where we were happy, and went in and cut 7 songs with the Dap Kings in 2 days. Like, it was cheaper, easier than anything you could imagine from a sort of modern production standpoint.
And they hold up. They're fairly timeless when they're real. And you just listen to music in the 80s. Where instruments were trying to fill the place where the horns were with either things that sounded like horns or things that they thought sounded like horns. And that stuff doesn't hold up.
It doesn't. And there's like, there's these punishing speakers that are the standard that you find in any recording studio, and they're called the Yamaha NS10s, and everyone uses them.
The ones with the little white cones.
Yeah, everyone uses them because they're just pretty unforgiving. And you can just, anytime you have 5 people playing in a room and you play it back to that, it's always going to sound amazing because that's pure music, that's harmony. Not to say I didn't grow up like loving hip-hop and sample records and that stuff too, but those are the records you always have to work, tweak, spend hours mixing to make sound good. Whereas if you just have 5 people that can really play well together and turn mics on in a studio and record to tape, you're going to be probably pretty good.
Let's pick something from, let's say, Amy Winehouse, where you get the Dap Kings in a studio. What's something that you're particularly proud of in the way it worked out on that record we can play?
Well, I think that, a lot of the songs me and Amy have pretty much demoed to a T and took in there, and then their playing really brought it to life. But I think one of the songs that actually really came alive in the studio was probably Love is a Losing Game, because I had it as a quite relaxed ballad, and then Homer the drummer came up with this really nice sort of old 60s soul drum beat on it.
Okay, great. Let's give a listen to that.
For you I was a flame. One eye.
like the beat a lot. I never really concentrated on just the drum beat. You got vibraphone going on in there.
Right, yeah, now. There's a lot of things in that song actually that kind of interesting sort of touchstone in the making of that record. First of all, Amy was like really adamantly against putting strings on anything. To her, strings meant like sugar syrupy, mm-hmm. like really crap pop music. So I was like, Amy, we got to put strings. And she's like, "Not, I'm not doing it." And I was like, well, all these records that you love and that we're referencing that are kind of classics like Shangri-La's, they all had strings. They were just like really thick and kind of muddy in the production, but it needs that. She's like, "Don't want it." I was like, "Well, how about if I pay for it? Don't waste your money." I was like, so I got to the point where she wasn't listening, so I had to do it kind of behind her back. And I just went in, and we'd done the strings on that song, and she came to hear the final mix, and it wasn't even the kind of thing that far down that we could have just muted the strings if she didn't like it. Yeah. So she came and she sat down, and she kind of had her head down in her hand the whole time we were listening, so I couldn't see if she liked it or not. And the song's over, and she just gets up and like gives me, with this beam, just gives me this huge hug, and she's like, "I love it." And I was just so relieved. And then she goes, "Except for that harp at the end of the second chorus, it sounds like some Mariah Carey bullshit. Take it out." And that was like a typical Amy way. And then that was kind of like, you know, what happened with the that's how we got that. And then I also remember doing things like the little trumpet line that goes on the second verse, that's doing the very backrack, the bop 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 bop. And and I was like, "Can you sing this like backing vocal thing?" And I sung it to her, and she goes, "Oh, can't you just get the trumpets to do it or something?" It was just like typical like Amy moments, but that all ended up making the stuff better, you know.
Where'd you fall in love with some of the things you're referencing here? You know, about 30-ish years old?
32.
So let's see, so if you were 32, so in the 80s, they didn't play much Burt Bacharach on the radio. The Shangri-La's certainly were hardly on the radio. Musical Family, and the trumpet thing, where are
they? You know what? The horn thing comes from my dad loves soul music. So growing up, all that kind of like Atlanta Rhythm Section, Tower of Power, the obvious stuff like Sly. But I got into funk music. I listened to like heavy metal, like Guns N' Roses and stuff, which I just finished reading Slash's autobiography, which is pretty good, by the way. And I just like loved all that kind of stuff. And then the early Def Jam hip hop, not early, but the sort of Public Enemy, Beastie Boys, LL era. And then as I started to get into DJing, I got super into hip hop and started to find these old funk records that they sampled. And some of it was the obvious stuff like James Brown, and some of it was the more obscure jazz funk stuff like Roy Ayers, that, you know, the Tribe Called Quest and those kind of groups were sampling. And then that kept sending me back, I guess, more and more in that kind of DJ digging thing. And I guess I just used to be all about like the sort of 70s funk and soul and the sound of like Stevie's songs in the Key of Life. And now I'm all about his sort of 60s recordings. As I get older, regressing in my taste, you know, time period.
I find it fascinating when people dig back and do the archaeological thing. I actually have so much trouble imagining learning this music backwards. And it must be fascinating to sort of dig toward the roots.
I think it is. I think it's been like there were times when I was 15 when I listened to Led Zeppelin and Blind Faith, and like little things like kind of mixed up along the way. It's probably not as like orderly as I made it sound, but I don't know. Like, I would just much rather listen to like a mono recording of an old Traffic album that sounds so raw, and you'd hear the drums and mic terribly, but the performance is incredible and that stuff. And I accidentally turn on the radio and hear like new things, and they just sound really bad to me. Not to say that I don't like, there's bands that I love now, like the White Stripes or Queens of the Stone Age, and there's people like Lily doing progressive things musically that I can enjoy. But other than that, it just sounds quite sterile, and I'm falling into like grumpy old man quicksand or something.
Well, when you were young, do you remember what you saved your pennies up for, or things that you loved as a kid that maybe you can play for us here?
I think a really important record for me, like when I was growing up, was I grew up in England, moved to New York when I was 8. So New York, if you were like a 10-year-old kid and you lived in the city, it seemed like hip-hop was everywhere and all the kids knew the words to like everything from Stetsasonic to 2 Live Crew. And then I was going back to England to visit my dad and discovering all this sort of Britpop stuff that I really like Blur and that. And the Stone Roses were the band for me that, when I first heard their record Fool's Gold, was the first thing that ever combined the breakbeat of sort of hip-hop with this Britpop melody that that just kind of basically is probably the blueprint for what my album really is now. It's sort of like Britpop melodies over sort of beats. So that's definitely one of those seminal records for me.
What song are we going to play?
Fool's Gold.
Great. We'll put the full song up on the website. I'm here with
Guest it's nine DJ, minutes.
Mark Ronson. Wow. That's a great sound. That is a great mix. And to be 10 and to recognize something in there.
I think that it was just the use of that breakbeat. It's a James Brown breakbeat from Hold On, I'm Coming. And it had already been used by Big Daddy Kane and Raw and like a lot of hip hop staples. And the bass line is sort of like a bastardized ripoff of a Young MC bass line. But then with that melody and everything quite moody over it. And when you're four guys from the north of England and Run DMC ends up sampling your record, you know that like you've obviously made something like quite seminal in the groove, you know.
Was that groove sampled or was that groove?
The groove is sampled. The drum beat is sampled, and I think they played on it. I met Manny once, the bass player, and just he's a bit of a rock icon in England because he's now in Primal Scream or whatever. And I just kind of like went all like starstruck fan, super fan. I was like, "How'd you do that? This one, that one." He's like, "Mate, I don't even remember." It was like we were so off our heads, mate. You know, but I think it's like played on top of the groove or something.
And did you then study music? Did you care to want to get into music?
I played a few instruments when I was the early age, you know, when you're five and you kind of play the instruments that your parents tell you. And I played violin a bit and piano. And then when I was 15, I started playing guitar and bands and stuff. But I was never amazing, honestly. There were always so many guitar players that were sort of better than me around. And I just realized that sort of producing was just something I gravitated more to, just kind of helping architect an entire song and sound and having ideas about arrangement as opposed to being a virtuoso at any one thing.
I would think that you'd have to know, to tell a horn player or a section of horn players what kind of chordings to play and stuff, one would think that you'd have to start hearing that music in your head. Do you hear music in your head when you hear a song bare? Do you start to hear what could work with it?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I hear stuff all the time, and it's always embarrassing because my pitch is not amazing, so it helps to have like a guitar nearby to play. But I was doing this thing yesterday, actually, in Philly. I was doing, I just did a song for Mary J. Blige's new album. It's a cover of Tove Rundgren, Hello, It's Me. And we went to...
I'm imagining that. Hang on. Okay.
It's great. It just sounds like the Todd version as opposed to like the Isley Brothers and the other R&B versions, the proper 60s one, just a bit more sort of like Curtis Mayfield. And I had these background singers. I was trying to tell them what to sing. And at one point, it just sounded like the scene in Spinal Tap when they're standing over the grave doing Barbershop Raga, like at Graceland. But the thing is that, like, I used to be one of those people that was really, like, timid and nervous, like, thinking that my ideas weren't valid and just like, oh, I'd like to tell them this, but why should I tell them I'm just a kid and they're going to laugh at me? And then I just realized that if you don't tell them, you're just going to be sitting around with this record that for 10 years from now you're going, I wish I had told them to play this part in the chorus. And I've just become, I guess, like, success gives you a little bit of confidence, I'm not going to lie. And like, yeah, I think a couple things that in the studio I feel a bit like now, like maybe I can say what I like without feeling like an idiot.
Well, you tackled something that, you know, took a little bit of chutzpah, the Dylan thing this year, which is, you know, taking a great song from, you know, Blonde on Blonde, and I mean, just doing anything with a song from Blonde on Blonde takes a bit of nerve. How'd that come to pass? And then I'd like to listen to it for people who haven't heard you do this.
I wish there was some more romantic story, like I got a phone call from Bob Dylan at 4 a.m, but I was sitting in the Columbia Records office in the UK, and they're like, listen, we're putting out this greatest hits of Bob Dylan, and we're going to have a few people try some remixes. Do you want to try something? And of course I said yes, and I just kind of spent like 2 months anytime I was on a plane, like, exhausting Bob Dylan's entire catalog and just really trying to make sure I had the right song. And obviously, most likely, the original has an amazing groove. It's got that kind of New Orleans second line drum thing going on and those amazing Nashville musicians. And I just thought, there's a song that I could take and probably do, you know, go in the studio with some of the Dap King guys and whatever and just make it groove a bit harder. I definitely wasn't trying to reinvent the wheel, and the nature of the old school 4-track recordings, it wasn't even like we had that much choice to just get, because we didn't have an isolated vocal anyway, because there's all this bleed and stuff. But that's kind of how it really came about. And then when we finished it, got something we were happy with, I sent it to Bob Dylan's management, and he said that he liked it, and that was kind of it.
Let's listen to it. It's Most Likely You Go Your Way and I'll Go Mine. It's Bob Dylan, done by Mark Ronson.
Could be wrong. You say you told me that you wanna hold me, but you know you're not that strong. I just can't do what I've done before. I just can't beg you.
For me, the mark of the fact that this worked, having heard the song 400,000 times without your production on it, was when I was humming it to myself, came into my head about 10 days ago, and the ba-da-da-da-da-da-da line came into my head, and I realized, well, that's part of the song.
You know, I was just listening to that. You know, it's funny, in the original, and what I've done on a lot of these covers is sort of pick out parts of the original arrangement I like and switch instruments, like I did on the Radiohead cover with the guitars becoming horns. And the organ, I noticed in really low in the background, is doing that in the original Bob Dylan recording. I was just like, that's a great line. We should take that and make the trumpet, you know, the trumpet do it. And then I heard recently Todd Rundgren on his album Faithful, he did a cover Most Likely I never realized, and I think he had the trumpet do that same line, which is really bizarre. I got a bit of flack for that, you know, like the same thing, taking on covers of sacred songs as well as, you know, remixing a Bob Dylan tune. But just listening to it just then, I was like, the people that were so incredibly offended, like, what did I really do except put like a breakbeaties type drum thing and like maybe some trumpets in it? Like the people that were like, this Mark Ronson thing is sacrilege and utter rubbish. Like, I just really think it's not even good enough or radically different enough to get that kind of vitriol.
People need to lighten up. I mean, they always have the original. It's not like you took it away from them and they don't have to listen to yours.
Actually, we're working on that. We're discontinuing the... we're burning Dylan's back catalog. You'll only be able to buy Ronson remixes.
That Mark Ronson guy! So tell me something that's new that I might not have heard that you might have brought today.
There's a couple things. There's a singer from the UK right now. It seems to be there's a sort of like big run of female singers. Like, it started kind of with Lily, Amy, and there's Kate Nash and a few other ones kind of busting through. And this girl, Adele, who's signed to XL is just amazing. She's just got this unbelievably powerful but like beautifully and kind of like scorched voice, and she writes great songs. And we worked together on one song on her album, this song called Cold Shoulder. And the cool thing about her is she's sort of like 19 and she's a bit singer-songwritery, but her like her whole crew is like sort of like the Jamie T and these kind of like English Rude Boys, which makes her thing a bit more kind of dark as well, as opposed to just being like sort of like this Nora Jonesy thing. And not that she would be musically, but anyway, I'm only saying that because I'm a big fan of her, the rest of her record. I only did one song on it, but this song called Cold Shoulder that we kind of just finished.
And this is Adele, A-D-E-L-E?
A-D-E-L-E, yeah. She's got a MySpace thing, and it's kind of like, she put out a tiny single, like, in the UK where people still get excited about 45s and things like that. She pressed up about 500 just to have the, you know, kind of introduction. And all of a sudden, Radio 1 went crazy and put on the A-list and playing it, like, 15 times a day. So I feel like she's going to be, like, one of the big, you know, kind of, like, musical breakthroughs for next year.
Well, let's give a listen. I like her. That sounds really good.
Yeah, it's she's got great voice. This kind of song she just wrote, just sent me a demo of her, the Whirly, just playing and singing by herself with this sort of like reggae feel on the keys. And one of those things where you just like kind of really search and go over it 100 million times so you really feel like you have the right arrangement for the song and the right attitude and everything.
Well, I mean, how much time can you spend in a studio working on something like this with a, you know, this is an artist that, what is she putting out, her first record, and the budget's probably not huge, and that's an awful lot of players.
Well, that's actually, but most of the stuff like the Amy Winehouse record, I realized that works well, and it's become a bit of my prototype that she'll come and play me the song and just show me what the chords are so I can play it myself on the guitar, and then she'll leave and I'll stay up till 5 in the morning just myself tinkering around with it, starting on the drums, the guitar, the keyboard, whatever it is first, till I find like I have an arrangement and a groove that can fit that song the best it can be. So it's not expensive because it's just me in the studio at the time that you're finding the arrangement and what works. And Amy would come in every morning the next morning and listen to songs. If she liked it, she would sing a rough vocal on it, and then that's what we took to the Dap Kings, those arrangements to play.
Are they charts that you're writing? Is it things that you're singing to the band?
It's kind of a combination of both. Like, the chords are charted, but basically I played, you know, enough of each instrument to play the whole demo and then play that for them and just go, play this, but much better, you know.
You have a great job.
Yeah. I play it really crap. You guys play it really good, and I look really good at the end of the day. That's kind of the MO.
pick me one more song. It's an artist. This, because this is fun. I hear a lot of music, but you're bringing stuff to the table I haven't heard. Give me another one.
There's a rapper from DC named Wale that I do a radio show on East Village Radio, and it's just people send me MP3s all day, and on Friday I spend hours just going through picking the stuff. And obviously people send you stuff that's not even labeled, so I played this record on the show, this hip hop record, and I loved it, and all my friends in the studio going, "What's this? This is really good." And I'm like, "I have no idea." So I said, "If anyone knows what this record is, it's really good. Can you let me know?" So the next day I get a call from this manager, and I love the fact that this kid from DC, who is like, could rap as well as Kanye, Lil Wayne, or any of the kind of proper hip hop, was also doing these remixes of Justice records and Lily Allen and rhyming over these stuff. And I just really like the fact, and you know, I came up loving hip hop and a bit bored, became bored in the past few years by how boring it's become, and Wale just kind of made me excited again. So he's actually signed to our label, we've been working together, and he came on the road with us, and he's been on the cover of Herb magazine with Justice, and he's really starting to blow up, like Jay-Z and all these guys are checking for him. But this is a record that he did over a Justice single, that, you know, the French electronica group called Dance. I think when you start it, you might want to skip to like 48 seconds in, because it's like from his own mixtape, so you're just going to hear him talking about how he was the first person to wear bathing ape in DC for about 40 seconds. So
yeah,
you might...
I heard it. Okay, good.
He's like, "Yeah, people say I had the bright colored shoes and I was the first one to wear that," and yeah, we can deal without that. Y'all boomer, you need you an MD like Esiason. Dominating other East Side shall commence, and I shall commence it. I'm the truth, Joe. Though they try to block me like moon yells, I know my call is worth like phone call. I get brain hurt day, I'ma know it all. More birds than I know it all. Who are y'all? Keep talking, but no one know none of y'all. Hit the green like running backs with no yards. No hole, acquainted with the floor. Overly loquacious, they call me say word. We can say word. Just so happens mine they prefer. Yours is deferred. We ahead of the curb, and they all look like the girls on Virgin. Cut beats, I'm a fucking word surgeon. Scalping sponge, this work. Thanks. Yeah. All night, whatever happens. On my way back home, now I'm in the zone. My SIM card's a bomb, they blowing up my phone. Kicks Hong Kong, vape in the garment, the face of hip-hop, my D.C. audience. And you niggas will acknowledge this. Born again, socialite, thanks climate. My climate is way higher than Lindsay Lohan nostrils. I'm powder. Sorry, Mark, I don't wanna offend your sister's good friend, but when my pen get in, it pretends in itself it's an entity, and it interferes and gets the best of me. So I'm one with that. I'm stuck with that. Yeah,
it's like a school of music. I mean, there's so many internal references and references to music he loves and people he loves in music, and it's like living in this nice bubble.
It is. It's like living in a weird guy with ADD non sequiturs head, but like it's so, he's so clever, and like I just heard things for the first time listening to that. I probably heard about 12 times, and what was really cool is we got to perform that about 3 weeks ago in the UK. We did a concert with the BBC Concert Orchestra. So imagine like all these like 50 string players playing that line. And I remember watching it back on TV, and there's a scene where he uses like profanity that probably most classically trained musicians aren't used to hearing. And it's for some reason at that point, they've zoomed in on the cello player who looks like he's just got an electric shock as Wale, the word comes out of his mouth. But I was thinking about that thing. I just heard for the first time he goes, "They all look alike, like the girls on Virgin." And I was just like, oh, that's what he's saying, like how the stewardess is on Virgin, all dressed and kind of look alike. But it's just funny, like, just the way he just puts words together, and it's really clever, but it's not nerdy, and I've really enjoyed working with him, and we're starting on his record really soon.
Well, play DJ one more time for us. Take us out. Give me a song on your CD that would be great to go out on.
The outro's good. If we're going out, it's kind of like a nice ride off into the sunset type thing.
Okay, that's good. Anything you want to say about this? There's clavinets and saxophones on this thing.
Yeah, there's a couple of songs that I wrote that I just wanted to put in as interludes, not to go like, hey, look, I can actually write something, but just more of just, I thought that a lot of my favorite records, those old school records, are kind of set up to have a bit of an arc, and I thought putting that at the end, and it's just this progression I wrote ages ago, and I was always trying to mess around with them before when you were saying about, do you hear music? Most of the time when people hear melodies in their heads, they assume, oh, that's a melody, I should put lyrics to that. But in some weird way, like when I hear melodies most of the time, they do sound better as horn lines in my head. And this is one of those kind of examples. Like, I was singing a melody over and over, and I was like, you know what, why write lyrics? Like, I'll just make the horn section play it, and it'll just be a bit more interesting.
Anybody ask you to do soundtracks yet?
Yeah, there's been a couple things. You know, I finally in the past year got to a point where I have a little bit of recognition as a producer and get to work with some great bands for the next year, and then maybe I'll think about the movie thing a bit down the line.
Well, you're doing great work. I look forward to the next project and the one after that, and keep enjoying.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for doing this today. Mark Ronson, he's a producer, he's a musician, and he has a whole lot of fun doing his job. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.